Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Israeli targeted assassination of the military leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip and assess the likely retaliation and possible military escalation between Israel and Hamas. MJ Rosenberg, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the former director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum, joins us to discuss the motives behind Prime Minister Netanyahu's apparent provocation. Then we will hear from Khaled El-Gindi, who previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel. We will look into what response might come from the new Egyptian government, who are close to Hamas, and how the Palestinian Authority will be further isolated and weakened by an escalating confrontation between Israel and Hamas. Then finally, we will look into the civil liberties and privacy aspects of the government hacking into personal emails and what kind of laws there are to protect citizens from both the government and those who abuse the internet. Gigi Sohn, the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the digital age, joins us. We will discuss how vulnerable ordinary citizens are if the government can snoop on the nation's top spy. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. At Media Matters, Rosenberg works to correct misinformation surrounding complex foreign policy issues. Previously, he served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum, and prior to that, spent 18 years within the United States government, 14 on Capitol Hill as an aide to Representatives Jonathan Bingham, Edward Feigin, Nita Lowry, and Senator Carl Levin. And from 1982 to 1986, he was the editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly this attack by the Israeli Defense Forces that killed the military leader of Hamas in Gaza is bound to have repercussions, isn't it? I mean, there's some way or other Hamas is going to retaliate. So with that in mind, what was Netanyahu thinking when he ordered this attack?
Well, I actually think that his main consideration is always Iran. He is desperately eager to get the United States to sign off on his plan to attack Iran, or to to back Israel if it attacks Iran. And he's been worried for the last few weeks about the rumors, and he may know that they're not rumors, that the United States is talking to the Iranians right now. And there's New York Times reported that Valerie Jarrett, the president's close friend and one of his top assistants, has been meeting with the Iranians. So the Israelis are worried that we're going to go after some kind of a deal with Tehran. And I think heightening tension and attacking Gaza and causing the whole Middle East to be to become embroiled in anti-Israel feeling and war and whatever will pretty much ensure that nothing happens on that front. I think that is his main consideration. The reason, only because that is the ball he consistently keeps his eye on, Iran.
Well, there's been a political reason for that, surely, for the last couple of years, and that is, as long as Netanyahu's talking about Iran, he doesn't have to talk about the Palestinian situation that's been sort of festering. I understand that part of it. But what about the delicate situation with Egypt? Surely.
This really puts President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in a very difficult situation. They have, promised that they're going to maintain the peace treaty with Israel, but, how can they do that when Israel unleashes another onslaught? It's almost as if Netanyahu is oblivious to all that. He just, remember, he has an election coming up in January, and a wartime leader can probably do better than a peace leader. So that's a consideration, too. Not just Egypt, but also Turkey. The president of Turkey is going to Gaza in a week or two. He is very close to, to Hamas and to the Palestinians in Gaza. What I mean, it intensifies Israel's bad relations with all its neighbors, even Jordan, which right now there are all kinds of anti-government demonstrations going on there. Jordan is Israel's close ally. This makes it really difficult for every Muslim friend of Israel to maintain any kind of friendship at all. It seems kind of crazy to me.
Well, MJ Rosenberg, again, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs, and he previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and served for 18 years on Capitol Hill, being an aide to a number of congresspeople and Senator Carl Levin. Now, the head of state of Qatar, which is playing a leading role in funding and perhaps arming the rebels in Syria, who you would think in terms of Israel are doing what Israel would like and certainly what the America and Europe would like, which is to get rid of the Assad regime and to weaken Iran's influence in the neighborhood. He, the Sheikh Al-Thani of Qatar, was in Gaza recently with a pretty generous checkbook in hand. Mm-hmm. What's his motive there, do you think?
Well, I think that you're talking about Doha, Qatar's region.
I'm sorry. Doha. I got that wrong, yeah.
Yeah, I think that in general, there is kind of a, more of a, Palestinian, a pan-Arab acceptance that, Hamas is going to be the major spokesman for the Palestinians, as the Palestinian Authority under Abbas looks weaker and weaker. So I think that the various sheikhdoms are weak with the people in the street. They're seen as which they are, as kind of as totalitarian, as not representing the people. One way to show that they're down with the people of the Arab street is to support the Palestinians in Gaza, and that's what he's doing. Israel does not have bad relations with any of those sheikhdoms, but this will complicate that as well.
So what then is likely to happen in terms of retaliation? I understand that the Israeli Defense Forces have been putting out some rather triumphant tweets, have they not?
Oh, yeah, they have been tweeting, mission accomplished, this guy killed. They already named this. I forgot what it is. Whenever they have a major military operation in Israel, they give it a nickname, like Operation Peace for Galilee, was what they called the Lebanon War in 82. They've already given this one a nickname, like a little hashtag name. So I think their plan is that there's going to be a real war. That this is the prelude to an invasion of Gaza. President Obama's press conference today, he wasn't even asked a question about this. So that just indicates, and the United States already has put out a statement saying it supports Israel. So Netanyahu feels like he always pushes against doors that seem like they might be open. And he looked bad after the election. Netanyahu, he supported Romney. He's trying to to test his strength, and I think he's going to see that he's pretty strong. The fact is that Hamas has weapons. They have this Fajr rocket that supposedly is capable of reaching deep into Israel. Who knows what's going to happen? But Netanyahu is a very cynical man, and so is his defense minister, Ehud Barak. So, I don't know. They could actually really want a full-fledged war.
Well, what will happen if they have a fully-fledged war against
Gaza and Hamas, what is the Palestinian Authority going to be doing there? That you mentioned, MJ Rosenberg, that they've already lost a lot of their credibility in the, both in the Arab world and within the Palestinian community. So what are they likely to do if that comes to pass?
You know, the Palestinian Authority, they are in a terrible position. They are going to the United Nations this month, probably around November 29th, to ask for recognition for observer status for Palestinians, for a Palestinian state at the UN. I mean, it really is a nothing kind of status. It's kind of like what the Vatican has. Already, the Israelis are saying that if they get this observer status, they will use their influence in Washington to cut off all aid to the Palestinian people. Already, the lobby's cutouts in Washington have already said we will cut off Palestinian aid. So anything that the Palestinian Authority does, no matter how insignificant it is, the Israelis seem ready to crush them. It's almost as if they prefer to deal with Hamas than deal with the Palestinian Authority. Because if you're dealing with the Palestinian Authority, you have to deal with them diplomatically. But if you're dealing with Hamas, you can deal with them militarily. And that is clearly what Israel prefers. But the Palestinian Authority is on the brink of collapse, I think. And this war by Israel against Gaza could really finish them off.
So, MJ Rosenberg, do you think that is a tactic, a calculated part of the equation on the part of both Netanyahu and Barak?
It doesn't really make sense. Why would they want the Palestinian Authority to collapse, except, historically, they are the ones who, they kind of built up Hamas, 20 years ago. So they would have a Palestinian, the Palestinian side would be someone they wouldn't be pressured to negotiate with. They would always rather have on the Palestinian side someone that the United States doesn't make them talk to. So a complete Hamas triumph in both Gaza and the West Bank might be what they prefer. Remember, they don't want to negotiate. That's the bottom line. And with Hamas, no one pushes them to negotiate. Certainly not the United States and not the Europeans.
So, again, I'm speaking with MJ Rosenberg, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. Previously, he served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum. Now, I would think that, and you mentioned Valerie Jarrett perhaps being involved in secret meetings with the Iranians, and that's why Netanyahu's trying to stir up trouble in Gaza to change the subject and perhaps scuttle any efforts to make a deal. And these recent elections, along with Sheldon Adelson, looked like Netanyahu was a big loser. What's going on in the Israeli press in that regard? My understanding is a lot of Israelis were very upset that Netanyahu was meddling in the United States election and so clearly taking sides because of his friendship with Romney. What are you hearing from the Israelis about, could that play against Netanyahu in an election, notwithstanding what you just told us earlier, that by starting a war, he will make himself a wartime candidate for the January elections?
Well, if President Obama reacted to Israel's, this onslaught with some coolness and put out a statement that was even-handed, unlike, previous statements in the last 4 years, and indicated that he was not, by that statement, that he was not exactly pleased by Netanyahu's behavior, that would weaken Netanyahu. Israelis would then say, well, look, he's got his actions on behalf of Romney have hurt us. So that could, that could weaken Netanyahu. However, the United States government has already, gone all in supporting Netanyahu on this, so I don't see that happening. The fact is, that President Obama is in a uniquely strong position to put the squeeze on Netanyahu. Israelis are very concerned about having a U.S. president who does not like the Israeli prime minister. But I don't see that Obama will take advantage of that. It just, you know, the signs we see, for instance, the United States already has said that we will not support the Palestinian, submission for observer status at the UN. So Obama is acting exactly as, one side of the pro-Israel, pro-Netanyahu, as he did in the previous term. So he has an opportunity to hurt Netanyahu right now. I don't see him using it.
Well, but the fact, if indeed it's a fact, MJ Rosenberg, that the Obama White House has sent an emissary in the form of Valerie Jarrett to negotiate secretly with the Iranians, that is a slap in the face to Netanyahu. I mean, he's been wanting the U.S. to join in a military strike against Iran and kept suggesting, remember what he did at the United Nations with that cartoon drawing of the bomb and drawing the red line. It couldn't be more explicit, this sense of urgency and the U.S. intelligence services have insisted that Iran's nowhere near a bomb. So I think in that regard, it looks like Netanyahu's lost. And if these sanctions bring the Iranians to the point where they'll make a deal that's transparent in terms of their nuclear ambitions, that could change quite a lot in the region, surely.
Yeah, and that is a good point. And I think, Ian, that might be exactly what President Obama is thinking, that he gives Israel a free pass on Palestine so that he can push where it most matters to him, which is avoiding this, a war with Iran. Unfortunately, however, the Palestinian people suffer in the meantime. But I think you're exactly right. That is, if in fact that's going on with Valerie Jarrett, and we are pursuing the diplomatic route, that would be a tremendous defeat for Netanyahu, and a defeat that would be most significant in terms of benefiting the United States. So I think you're right about that.
So the other wild card then is Syria, right, in terms of changing the equation there if the Assad's fall. And clearly there's a long stalemate, and it may go on for some time more. The impression you get is that time is against Assad. There were some Syrian mortars were fired on the Golan Heights in the Israeli military retaliated and struck artillery positions in Syria. What do you think's going on there? Is that some peculiar provocation on the part of Assad to try and...
No, I don't think so. I think that neither Syria nor Israel wants any war on that front. Basically, Israel has had de facto peace with Syria since 1973. Assad is a very realistic player when it comes to his, powerful neighbor to the south. I think the Israelis have to worry about who will take over next. But I can't see either the Israelis or the Syrians wanting to engage right now. The only possibility could be that maybe Syria, maybe Assad thinks, well, a war with Israel right now could unite his people. But that seems awfully far-fetched. So I'm willing to take both sides on face value. The shells landed by accident, and Israel just responded with a warning shot saying, don't do it again. I don't think there's more to it than that. I do think that in general, Israel being so powerful is what they call a status quo power, which means it preferred to have, Mubarak in there. It prefers to have Hussein in where he is. And even though Assad is allied with Iranians, I think that Assad is a status quo leader of Syria. And I think Israel is more comfortable with him than with whatever this opposition force is going to be. But who knows? The game these people play is kind of like beyond my ability to discern what they're thinking. But this is my guess.
Well, MJ Rosenberg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
OK, Okay, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. At Media Matters, Rosenberg works to correct misinformation surrounding complex foreign policy issues, and previously served as director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and spent 18 years on Capitol Hill as an aide to Representatives Jonathan Bingham, Edward Figen, Nita Lowry, and Senator Carl Levin. And from 1982 to 1986, MJ was editor of the Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting a perspective on Egypt's likely reaction to the Israeli attack on Gaza.
Strikes now, so it would strike in me. Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who is a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009. And was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And already the Egyptian government of President Mohamed Morsi have condemned the Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza, demanding a ceasefire, and basically accusing Israel of seeking to drag the region towards instability. What's your take on what happened? You have to assume that Netanyahu knew when he ordered this strike that there would be a tit for tat. Isn't the retaliation inevitable?
Sure, and it's been very predictable that we've had these tit for tat periodic escalations in the past. Over the past few years, we've seen the cycle of escalation and ceasefire, escalation and ceasefire, and sometimes the escalation is bigger than other times, and there are concerns that it'll get even bigger. And I think this is one of those cases where things did escalate to a point where the Egyptians are... the Egyptians have always been involved in terms of trying to broker ceasefires, and because they have a border with Gaza. it is a predictable outcome. I think the more you escalate, the more we're likely to see a response. And you can see that in one of the stated Israeli goals of this operation, and this are... according to the Israeli military, is to restore their deterrent capability. The deterrent from rocket fire into Israel from Gaza, and that is what they're trying to deter. There are many different ways to go about deterrence, and military means alone is unlikely to achieve that deterrent goal that the Israelis seek.
Well, in a way, though, we've seen this movie before, I'm sad to say. After the assassination of... leading up to the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and afterwards, when Netanyahu came to power, there were a lot of targeted assassinations against Palestinians that led to the very responses that were predictable and that, in fact, enabled Netanyahu to come to power, in effect. Rabin's widow, Leah, always accused Netanyahu of being responsible in part for the death of her husband. So he's got an election coming up in January. Is he trying to become a wartime president? I mean, he's in trouble at home because he's so overtly supported Mitt Romney. And I think a lot of Israelis are concerned that Netanyahu may have alienated the White House, and they want good relations with the United States. So is there a domestic component to this, do you think, in terms of Israeli politics?
I think there's always a domestic component for any country that is operating. There's always a consideration of how it impacts domestic policy, and I think that's certainly true in Israel as well. So, I think the logic on the Israeli side is we cannot have Israeli communities that are being bombarded by rockets go unanswered, because we, the Israeli government, will be held accountable come election time. Israeli citizens expect to be safe in their homes, in their schools, in their communities, and we have a responsibility to do that. That's the most obvious direct line in terms of domestic Israeli politics. There may be more to it than that. I don't know. I think it's also true that there's an American political domestic component as well. You know, the leader of Israel doesn't undertake an action like this without calculating what the response is going to be from their neighbors in the region, from the United States, and within the United States, what the response is going to be from Congress, from the White House, from the security establishment, from the president's national security team. All of these had to have gone into the calculation, into the thinking of undertaking this kind of an operation. So I think American politics is also on Netanyahu's mind. I'm not saying it's the sole motivation or the most important motivation, but it would be, I think, unusual if it didn't factor in.
So if that's the case, then first of all, Israel has a very delicate relationship with this new Egyptian government, and this is clearly not helping. They have a treaty which they want to preserve, and it's unpopular in Egypt. So a similar situation exists, I believe, in Jordan, where there's a treaty, but it's also unpopular, and there's a lot of pressure on the Jordanian king from his own restive population. And then you've got the Palestinian Authority, who are looking kind of impotent in this situation. So I don't understand what the logic behind a provocation is, unless you're saying it's just entirely to do with stopping rocket attacks.
Well, I think you have to look beyond the immediate actors on the ground. You have to look at the broader regional situation and rivalries and power configuration that exists in the region. And you have a government in Israel that is determined to scale back what they perceive as an Iranian threat, a nuclear capability threat, or at least the potential of a nuclear Iran, and that they see that as their number one threat in the region. And you have inside Gaza, Hamas, which is, they are casting, they're talking about in terms of an Iranian-backed terrorist organization, quote-unquote. And I think we partially have to see this in those regional terms as well. This is a message, you know, Iran has very few friends left in the Arab world. And now you have this alignment of forces in the region and in the international community against Iran. And Hamas is one of the few friends, in the sense, that Iran still has. And so this is partly, I think, a proxy war between Israel and Iran. It's partly, I think, a message to Egypt and a way to test the new Egyptian government and their resolve, test the durability of the peace treaty. Will a Muslim Brotherhood-backed government maintain the treaty? Will they respond any differently to this than the Mubarak regime did? You know, the Morsi government withdrew their the Egyptian ambassador from Tel Aviv. It's a similar type of action that Mubarak did in the past in similar circumstances. So I think there are lots of different angles to this, in addition to the direct stakeholders on the ground. And then, of course, you have in the context of this split between Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank and Gaza, would this be likely if you had a unified Palestinian polity in which there was one president over both the West Bank and Gaza, would Israel have as free of a hand to act in Gaza as it is now, I think, is another question. I think one thing that has to come out of this is people need to start thinking on how to resolve these multiple crises at the same time, because they have similar solutions. You know, you cannot resolve the situation between Gaza and Israel without also tackling the situation between the rift between Hamas and Fatah on the Palestinian side, and also without tackling the security issues that Egypt has on its borders between the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. And also Israel has an interest in clamping down on the arms, weapons smuggling into Gaza. So there is in this kind of multi-layered crisis situation, there is actually an opportunity to try and resolve all of these different conflicts in a much more durable way, instead of treating them as separate and independent crises. They all are interconnected. And I'll give you an example. After the last Gaza war, it was, if you look at Palestinian opinion polls in 2009, it was Abu Mazen, the Palestinian president in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, who suffered the biggest loss in his popularity. He took the biggest hit politically precisely because of that perceived impotence. And I think we're likely to see Abbas be another unintended consequence or victim of this operation as well. If the target may be Hamas on the ground, but the victim may actually be the leadership in the West Bank because of their inability to do anything.
Again, I'm speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So my understanding is that there are secret negotiations going on between the Obama White House and the Iranians, perhaps involving Valerie Jarrett. Is that possible that this has provoked Netanyahu? In other words, he's always wanted to basically say that Iran is the real problem. And the more we talk about Iran and talk about bombing Iran, etc., the more the Palestinians become irrelevant. And frankly, the Palestinian issue has been on pretty much invisible now for the last couple of years. So is that what's going on here? He's, he's sort of sided with Romney. He's lost out, and maybe Obama doesn't owe him anything and is going his own way with the Iranians. And this is one way of changing the subject.
I mean, I definitely think there is an Iran dimension to this escalation and this situation on the ground in Gaza. I can't speak to the specifics. I don't have that kind of inside information about whether these secret talks are happening or whether this is part of that process or a motivation in that. But I think it's plausible that Israeli concerns about Iran are at least partly motivating this response and this escalation. I mean, this didn't have to escalate to this point. In the past, there have been these flare-ups. There was a ceasefire called, and we looked actually for a moment like we were, the Egyptians were frantically trying to broker a ceasefire, and there was talk of, all the factions had agreed. It looked like a ceasefire might be imminent, and then we saw the assassination of a Hamas military commander and other targets, Hamas targets, and so there was this dramatic escalation on the part of Israel. So I think it's at least partly related to Iran. I think you can't take Iranian concerns out of the equation. I think it's clearly part of Israeli thinking. But there's a broader regional dynamic at play. There is, like you said, a very fragile relationship with Egypt. And then I'm sure that's also part of what is being tested. There is a situation between Palestinians. How will this affect the chances for Palestinian unity? If anything, it might push the two back together. At the end of the day, this is a political problem, and it will have to have a political solution. It can't purely be a military one. And there are political realities on the ground that need to be accommodated and taken into account on all sides, on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, on the Egyptian side. And so all of those have to be factored in. Otherwise, we're going to see just more instability and continued flare-ups. And that's not good for anyone. We need a longer-term, holistic and integrated approaches and solutions, and not simply one-dimensional, one-sided fixes that create more instability.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Khaled El-Gindi.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the implications of a government that can snoop on America's top spy. What does that say about the privacy of the rest of us? This your war, 'cause until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, and the rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Well, everywhere is welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gigi Sohn, who's the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. She has served as a project specialist in the Ford Foundation's Media, Arts, and Culture Unit, and as executive director of the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm that represents citizens' rights before the FCC and the courts. In May 2006, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Gigi Sohn the Internet Pioneer Award, and she is a member of the advisory board of the Future of Music Coalition and the Center for Public Integrity's Well Connected Telecommunications Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gigi Sohn.
Great to be here, Ian.
And it's pretty extraordinary to think that the government can snoop on the private emails of the head of the CIA, the nation's top spy. What does it say about how the rest of us are vulnerable?
Well, I think what it says is that all of us are vulnerable. It doesn't matter what position of power we might have. And also it shows how little even the smartest people in our country, leaders of our country, know about what happens online. I think there's a real need for people to get digitally literate. In other words, they need to know not only how to use online tools, but also how other people use them, how corporations use them, how government uses them. And it is astounding to me the lack of knowledge that folks have about, you know, what one's vulnerabilities and, frankly, what one's rights are in the online space.
Well, my understanding, though, in terms of policing the online space, and in particular the FBI, that they do have a cyber crimes unit, but for a citizen, a regular person, to get the FBI's attention, that's a pretty high bar. And what's extraordinary in the case of General Petraeus and the housewives gone wild down in Tampa, Florida, is how this became a case in the first place. I've spoken to people who have been harassed in the most hideous ways online, and they simply can't get anybody to deal with it, and yet they jumped at this one. So what's going on with the FBI?
Well, I think the more salient question is what's going on with the law. So we have a law that is now 26 years old. It's called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and that sort of sets the baseline as to where government can snoop on citizens. The problem is that in 26 years, the technology has changed enormously. I mean, we didn't have a commercial internet in 1986. We didn't have the kind of cloud services where you put your data on a bunch of web servers in 1986. So technology has far surpassed the law, and what has happened is both government and corporations have taken advantage of that fact to engage in the kind of data collection and snooping that really concerns citizens.
So, in other words, we simply don't know how much we are exposing ourselves every time we go online or make a tweet or send a text. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right. I mean, I think most people don't have the slightest idea of what they're exposing themselves to for a matter of data collection or government snooping when they get online, when they use Gmail. These are not secure tools. And somebody as smart and as high-powered as David Petraeus didn't know it either. So I think that's number one. And the second thing is, I think people do expect that the laws would protect this kind of activity against it happening, and unfortunately that's not the case either. So it's not only a matter of folks not being literate in the digital world, it's also a matter of our laws being grossly outdated and needing to be updated as soon as possible.
Again, I'm speaking with Gigi Sohn, who's the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. So in terms of the FBI's cybercrimes unit and this case that exposed this affair between David Petraeus and his biographer, came about under the statute of cyber harassment, apparently. And my understanding is that the FBI's main focus in terms of its cyber crimes unit is on, you know, hackers penetrating government computers and pedophiles. So in terms of citizen victims of internet harassment, what laws are there to protect them?
Not very many. And I think this is a case, and it's not the only case, of government prosecutors basically going beyond the bounds of the law. There's no cyber harassment law that I know of, or one that specifically, you know, gets to the kind of activity we're talking about here. But, you know, I think prosecutors have basically take what laws are on the books and sort of expand their jurisdiction to meet their needs. I think we're seeing this in the copyright area as well, where prosecutors have taken a provision from a 2008 law that said that government concedes the tools that are used for copyright infringement, and they've gone and they've used it to seize websites. So when there's really no law that speaks directly to the issue at hand, then, you know, prosecutors use their discretion, as they're often allowed, to stretch the bounds of those laws.
But in terms of isn't there a fundamental difference, though, between the internet and, say, conventional publishing like newspapers and broadcast media in terms of libel, for example? I mean, my understanding is that internet service providers are immune, as unlike newspaper publishers, and the onus is on the person who might be conducting the libelous activity rather than the person who publishes it. Am I correct?
Well, it depends. It depends on the area. So if I can get back to copyright again, if somebody posts an infringing document or infringing movie, the intermediary, usually either the website person, you know, whoever has got the website up there, the website owner, or the internet service provider like an AT&T or Verizon, they must first take that offending material down. And if they don't, so they have responsibilities, okay? The responsibility doesn't automatically pass through to the offending person, the person who committed the infringement or posted the infringing material. So it's not always the case that the intermediary gets a free pass. When it comes to libel and defamation, yes, that is the case. There's something called the CDA Section 230, or the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that says basically in all cases, again, except for copyright and trademark, if the intermediary is just being a pass-through, if they have no editorial discretion over what's being said or what's being posted, they get a free pass. And that's a fantastic law. I wish it applied to copyright as well. It does not. But as a general rule, that is the case, but there are exceptions here and there.
Well, Gigi Sohn, in terms of the Petraeus case, which allegedly began with a cyber harassment complaint by this woman down in Tampa, Florida, against David Petraeus' biographer, and that, of course, led. They had a way that they were communicating in sending drafts, right, to each other on a common Gmail, I think. But, for example, I know somebody whose career has been destroyed by cyber harassment from some person who's obviously a little unhinged and who's just been saying the most terrible things about this person and constantly posting these outrageous claims about this person online. And eventually this person contacted the attacker. And what the attacker more or less said was, if you pay me, I'll stop, which is by any definition
blackmail.
Extortion.
Yes.
But still, my understanding is that this person can't get into court.
Yeah, well, look, we have a First Amendment in this country, and we have to balance, you know, we have to balance freedom of speech against speech we don't like. And, you know, sometimes the losers in that balance are people who are very, very sympathetic. Look, the libel and defamation laws, they still apply in the online world. Again, the intermediary is not responsible, but the, you know, the person who commits that libel or defamation, if it meets the legal definition of libel and defamation, it can be, you know, called into court and punished for that. But you're absolutely correct. We don't have laws that cover every instance of bad behavior online, And that's because we have a First Amendment that we have to balance. You balance the equities there. And yes, that's horrible. That is what has happened to your friend. But I think sometimes that's the price we pay to be in a free society. I question what a narrowly crafted cyber harassment law would look like. It probably would encompass a lot of speech that we would want to be free. And it would be abused by prosecutors when things, you know, aren't as harassing. I think it would be very, very difficult to craft a law that doesn't have very bad unintended consequences for free speech in this country. And that's, like I said, sometimes our First Amendment rights have to be balanced against, you know, the rights of victims, and sometimes the victims win, and sometimes the First Amendment wins, and, you know, it's not a perfect balance.
So, Gigi Sohn, then what is the responsibility of, say, Google? In this case that I'm referring to, if you type in this person who's being harassed, if you type their name in, it immediately the harassing documentation comes up because this person continually posts and therefore gets at the top of the queue. And Google are not in any way saying that they're responsible for what's going on and they won't do anything about it. Now, there was a case, I believe, where Google was sued in Australia recently and they lost. So give us an update on where things stand and what is the responsibility of say, a Google in this matter.
Well, again, it's hard to say. I mean, again, to the extent that Google is not the, you know, is not the editor there, they don't really have responsibility. Although I will say, there are, you know, other situations now. At the risk of beating a dead horse, in the copyright space, they are now saying that if a site is alleged to be infringing, it will come up lower in the search standings. Okay, so it won't come up at the top. It'll come up closer to the bottom, and it'll be tagged, you know, with a tag that says, you know, this has been alleged to be infringing. So in some areas, you know, they've been willing, or at least they've felt pressured. I don't think Google wants to do it, but they feel pressured that in the copyright space that they have to sort of do this, you know, lowering the search of these allegedly infringing websites. And I know they do block abusive websites as well. They certainly block pornographic websites when that's brought to their attention. So they have the capability of doing it. I think the problem for them is if they do it too much, then do they lose their immunity as, you know, as a simple search engine? At that point, do they have to edit everything? And when they start to become an editor, all of a sudden there's a lot of responsibilities and liability that comes with being an editor. So I think they have a difficult, you know, I'm not defending what they've done here and what they've done in the other places, but I'm just saying, you know, to the extent that it starts to pick and choose what websites get blocked and what websites don't, particularly if there isn't a law against it, all right? So we have laws against pornography. We have, you know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that places responsibilities on intermediaries when it comes to copyrighted material. We don't have similar laws when it comes to harassment. So if all of a sudden you're going to go beyond the law and start to, you know, pick and choose what is, you know, what's an appropriate link and what isn't, then all of a sudden you put yourself in the position where you can be found liable because you have this editorial control over your search engine. So it's a very delicate balance, and I can't really fault Google for wanting to err on the side of not blocking as opposed to blocking.
Well, just in closing, Gigi Sohn, Google did lose this case in Australia. I believe it involved somebody who'd been publicly accused of murder, and they sued and won. But the point is that apparently Google was quite vigorous and obviously spent some serious money in defending itself. So what kind of line are they holding here?
Look, Australia does not have a First Amendment, and that's what I keep coming back to.
Sure.
All right? We operate under different rules in this country than in pretty much any other country in the world. I mean, Google has problems with, you know, the fact that it's not blocking certain links and it's not blocking certain videos on YouTube all over the world. I mean, they have enough counsel all over the world because every single jurisdiction is different. So that's why it's different in Australia, and these companies have to make a decision, you know, do I, you know, where it's a more repressive regime, and Australia obviously is not the height of repressiveness, but talk about Thailand, where you can't post YouTube videos making fun of the king or something like that. They have to make difficult decisions. Do I operate there and give the people there some taste of freedom, or do I say, look, I cannot abide by, you know, the different rules that you've got here, some of which are censorious, and I'm going to leave. It's difficult. It's a profit-making enterprise. I'm sure they want to be in as many countries as possible. They did close up shop, at least for a while, in China because they couldn't abide by those rules. But I think looking at what happened in Australia is really not apropos of what happens here in the United States, because we have a constitution and we have the right to freedom of expression. I think 999,000 times out of, you know, out of a million, that's better for citizenry than it is for corporations. Or for some harasser. But I think, you know, every once in a while, it kind of goes on the other side of the ledger, and, you know, ordinary innocent people are the lesser for it.
Well, I think your point's well taken, Gigi, because American revolutionaries, the reason they felt so strongly about the First Amendment was that the British libel laws shut down all opportunities of dialogue and debate before the revolution, in effect, the very same laws that Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson and et cetera were railing against are in place to this day in both England and Australia. So there's no question that the First Amendment is one of the great gifts to human freedom.
Yep.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Gigi.
My pleasure, anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Gigi Sohn, who is the co-founder and president of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. She has served as a project specialist in the Ford Foundation's Media, Arts, and Culture Unit and as executive director of the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm that represents citizens' rights before the FCC and the courts. In May 2006, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gave Gigi Sohn its Internet Pioneer Award, and she is a member of the advisory board of the Future of Music Coalition and the Center for Public Integrity's Well-Connected Telecommunications Project. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm